This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome, beloved listeners, to another edition of LNL on RN Summer. The program is devoted to an article which struck a raw nerve around the world last year. A quotation from it. As the world struggled to come to terms with COVID-19, this pandemic saw the world focused on the same existential threat, probably for the first time in history. Consumed by the same fears and eagerly anticipating the same as yet unrealised promises of medical science. Now, the pandemic, of course, went hand in hand with the United States of America reeling from huge numbers of COVID deaths, with a president who seemed to confuse the pandemic with the common cold. Professor Wade Davis wrote his opinion piece for Rolling Stone, and it hit a nerve. I'm disinclined to say it went viral, but hundreds of millions read it all over the world. Wade's thesis is that COVID-19 signals the end of the American era. Wade holds the leadership chair in Cultures and Ecosystems at Risk and is Professor of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia in Canada. 20 books under his belt, the most recent of which we will also cover in this interview, is called Magdalena, the River of Dreams, based on that great river of Colombia. Firstly, I congratulated Wade on the Rolling Stone article and asked him about the number of readers.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a funny story. You know, you've been in journalism a long time, and the story kind of becomes about the story. I mean, I had resisted the idea of writing about COVID. I wasn't sure if I had anything to say. There was a lot of noise out there. And, you know, I live off the coast of British Columbia, and I went for a little paddle one day, and it suddenly dawned on me that COVID really wasn't a story about medicine. It wasn't a story of morbidity and mortality. It was a story about culture. And I came to shore late in the evening, and by chance, a friend of mine, a physician, a wonderful, brilliant woman, Trish Beattie, was there. I said, "Trish, you know, this isn't a story about medicine, is it? It's a story about culture." And she sort of beamed at me. And I went home that evening and wrote this piece and sent it to an old friend of mine, Jan Wenner at Rolling Stone. Jan took it to his editors, and before, you know, it came out, and it just hit a nerve. It's had over 4 million readers at the Rolling Stone site. It's had over, as you suggested, 200 million media impressions. I think we're both old enough to know that we don't have any idea what that really means. But the point is, you know, the interesting thing about it is it hit a nerve. And, you know, the response has not been negative. People haven't seen it as an anti-American piece, which really makes me grateful. The overwhelming response has been sadness. And I think of the piece as a kind of a family intervention. I'm often described as a Canadian who has written this piece about America. People forget that I was born in Canada, but, you know, I became a naturalized American. My wife's American. My children were raised in both places. I found my education in the States. My career could never have happened in Canada as it did in the States. My father-in-law was almost U.S. president, and instead he chose to bring down Nixon in an incredibly courageous way. And, you know,
stop. I need information on that. Please tell me.
Well, my father-in-law was Senator Charles Percy, and in 1968, President Nixon offered him the vice presidency, but Granddaddy endorsed Rockefeller. And then when Watergate began to unravel and Agnew had to resign, a deal was actually struck between my father-in-law, because you don't run in the United States for president when you want to. It's when it's your turn. And 76 was his turn. And so he cut a deal with Gerry Ford that Ford would become the vice president on the condition he did not run in 76. And of course, then constitutionally, after Nixon unexpectedly had to resign, Gerald Ford became president, and my father-in-law went to the White House a few months later and said, "Jerry, about that deal we had." And President Ford said, "Chuck, I kind of like this job." And that was that. But there's even a better story. When Watergate first broke, my father-in-law called up Barry Goldwater, and my father-in-law was the liberal wing of the Republican Party. He came out earliest against Vietnam. He was he got John Lennon his green card, if you can imagine. And he was extraordinarily progressive man, incredibly decent and kind man. And he calls up Barry Goldwater and says, "Look, you know, we've got to go over and talk to this guy." So they go over to the White House and they meet in the Lincoln bedroom with Nixon. And both of them say the obvious: "You've just won the greatest plurality in the history of American politics. We're still in war in Vietnam. The campuses are on fire. The cities are on fire. Just come clean and say you made a mistake. It'll be over in a news cycle." And then Nixon turned to both of them and said, "You know, I'd like to be able to do that, fellas, but it would just mean I'd have to lie to the American people because I didn't know anything about Watergate." And that's why Barry Goldwater never went to Nixon's funeral, because that son of a bitch lied to him. That's what Barry said. And that was a real turning point in American history. But that was the kind of Republican Party that existed then, you know?
I'm glad I interrupted you. That's a wonderful story in parentheses.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think my father-in-law would be just so appalled by what's going on. You know, I mean, my father, you know, one of the things about this article I wrote, you know, it's a love letter to America. It's like a family intervention. It's like you're holding a mirror. You know, you've got a family member in trouble. You've got to hold the mirror to them to see how far they've fallen if they're going to take that first step in the path of rehabilitation and redemption.
Well, I entirely agree. When I started calling it a failed state, it wasn't exultantly, it was sadly. I mean, and both of us would accept that over the decades, the world has had good cause to both fear and admire America, but not so much to pity it.
Well, that's that's a wonderful thing you just said, and that there was a great piece in the Irish Times about that, you know. And I'm not saying COVID means the unraveling of America. It's that COVID is revealing to us the unraveling state of America. You know, let's go back in history for a moment. You know, empires are born to fall. Kingdoms are born to die. Few of them anticipate their demise. You know, the 15th century belonged to Portugal, the 16th to Spain, the 17th to the Dutch, the 18th to the French, the 19th, obviously, to the British. And amazingly, the British Empire reached its greatest geographical extent in 1935. I mean, people were drinking gin and tonics in more places in the world than ever before. And yet now, of course, we know that the empire was probably gone by the Diamond Jubilee. It was certainly bankrupt and bled white by the Great War. And so the torch had already passed to America. And it's amazing, you know, on the eve of World War II, America was a demilitarized society. With Europe ablaze in 1940, America had a smaller army than either Bulgaria or Portugal. And yet within 3 years, 18 million men and women would serve in uniform. You know, the industrial might of America saved literally civilization. That's why neither you or I gloat at the idea of the demise of America.
Well, one of the points you make is that Henry Ford was rolling out bombers at the rate of T model Fords, and yet now America was finding it hard to roll out face masks.
Well, that's a cruel irony, isn't it? I mean, you know, the Willow Run plant, every B-24 had 1.5 million parts, and they said it couldn't be done. He did it. Every 2 hours, the record for Liberty ships, which they spat out two a day, was four days, 29 hours, and 17 minutes. The Ford Motor Company in World War II produced more industrial output than Italy. The Chrysler had one plant, the Detroit Arsenal, that produced more tanks than the German Third Reich. When the Japanese took 95% of the world's rubber supply within 6 weeks of Pearl Harbor, we set in motion industrial development that led to synthetic rubber. We dropped the speed limit to 35 miles an hour. You know, it goes on and on. Here's a great one for you. Here's a quiz. Here's a quiz for all you wonderful Aussies. Okay. for every four, given that, you know, Australia and Darwin in particular were threatened by the Japanese, for every 4 pounds of equipment the Empire of the Sun got to a single troop, you know, soldier per capita, bullets, blankets, bedding, petroleum, guess how many pounds the Americans got to a soldier in the Pacific War?
I'm going to have to call for advice like you do in a television quiz.
I'm not putting you on the spot, mate. Two tons. And that was across 13,000 kilometers of water. I mean, the industrial capacity of America, together with the blood of Russian soldiers, of course, the Russians were responsible for 85% of the German casualties. So, but, you know, without even blinking, the Americans sent 500,000 Dodge trucks to the Russians, 500,000 radio sets. You know, Russian soldiers marched into Berlin on boots made in Pittsburgh. So you had this amazing industrial explosion. And then the war ends. Europe's in ashes. Asia's in ashes. 5% of the world's population, America, controls half the world's economy, 93%. Of the world's automobiles. And that dominance and affluence allowed for the truce between labor and capital that gave us the middle class. So that throughout the 1950s, golden era of American capitalism, you know, a working man with limited education could readily support a family, buy a house, buy a car, send his kids to good schools. And that contract was the basis of democracy in America. And it's that contract that has been so severely eroded to the point where today, and this gets back to this idea that what COVID revealed to us at a time when, you know, 2,000 Americans were dying a day, an American was dying every minute of every hour of every day throughout the country. Americans awoke to find themselves suddenly in a failed state. Led by a dysfunctional government, led by an individual who was advocating the use of cleansing fluids for a disease that intellectually he could not begin to understand. And you know, meanwhile, the society is kind of fractured between the haves and the have-nots. In the 1950s, it wasn't a golden era, and the American right is always invoking a nostalgia for a world of the 50s that never really existed, that has to sort of be imagined to have existed to rationalize their fear of change and their contempt for the social movements that did transform the society, men, women, gay people, whatever. But in fact, the economy in the 50s resembled Denmark more than America of today. The marginal tax rates were 90%. Now, people didn't pay 90%, but the message was there that, you know, they got around it. But, you know, the message was there, no, you will pay. You know, I you know, executive wages, my father was the CEO of Bell & Howell Company. He was completely focused on his workforce. You know, his own salary was maybe 20 times that of a white collar worker in his corporate family. But every single year, Granddaddy insisted on going to every plant Bell and Howell had, and they were 12,000 employees. He shook hands with everyone to tell them that they mattered, right? And today you have a situation where 1% of Americans control $30 trillion of assets, and the bottom half have more debt than assets. The three richest have more money than the poorest 160 million. And so when COVID comes along, you know, a country that once spat out beef 24s by the hour couldn't manage to create masks and swabs to track the disease. You know, a president orders, you know, disinfectants for a phenomenon he can't understand. And so as America, and this gets back to what you said about the Irish article, you know, as primary healthcare workers in America, the country that's beat smallpox, beat polio, that has been at the forefront of medical innovation, you know, for all of the modern era, when our frontline workers were eagerly waiting shipments of emergency supplies of basic elements from China, the hinge of history moved to the Asian century.
We interrupt this program to let you know that this is LNL on RN Summer. You're hearing the voice of Wade Davis, Professor of Anthropology from the University of British Columbia in Canada. His article on the end of the American century, published in Rolling Stone magazine, made waves around the world. I'm sorry that your grandfather is not around, because I still have a Ballon Howl stuck somewhere at the farm, and it still works, and from time to time I haul out a 16mm film I want to study. Now, let's go back to the starting point of the unravelling of America, this marvellous essay of yours, and you say, for the first time in the history of the world, all of humanity, informed by the unprecedented reach of digital technology, has come together, focused on the same existential threat, consumed by the same fears and uncertainties, eagerly anticipating the same as yet unrealized promises of medical science. But there are precedents for this unprecedented time, are there not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point. I mean, you know, epidemics have always created inflection points of history. The most classic example, of course, is the Black Death that killed half of Europe in the 14th century, and the reduction of the labor force led to new opportunities that led to the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, which transformed the medieval system that had been in place for 1,000 years. But even more recently, the Spanish flu in the wake of the Great War, millions and millions died, including my grandfather, who walked out in the morning and was dead by afternoon. But the critical thing is that the Spanish influenza had much higher rates of morbidity, but it happened at a time when the entire world was numb with death because of the Great War. By the same token, in the summer of Woodstock, as 500,000 young American kids took drugs and swam around in the mud of a farmer's field in New York State, the Hong Kong flu killed 100,000. And in Berlin, they were storing corpses in subway stations because the morgues were overrun. But again, that happened at a time when, first of all, global digital connectivity was not yet available, so people didn't know what was going on. And secondly, it happened at a time when most people in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, America had never been in an airplane, so the disease wasn't transmitted in this way. I mean, the critical thing about COVID is not the morbidity or mortality, but how it revealed a nation utterly unprepared. And in doing so, it reveals what America has become, which is a theme that you've been investigating as a journalist, you know. And a lot of what this is all about, some of it was just the shift in history, you know, that affluence in the 50s was by definition an artificial moment of dominance because of what had happened in the Second World War. But, you know, this whole idea of globalization, which has been sort of celebrated with iconic intensity, particularly in the United States, well, any working man or woman can see that it's nothing more than capital on the prowl in search of cheap labor. And as these jobs were shipped overseas, and as the, you know, corporate leaders continued to feather their nest, as we know they did, it created a tremendous sense of demoralization, to the point where today, let's look at some of the stats. Two-thirds of the world's antipsychotic drugs are used by Americans. You know, the biggest cause of death of Americans under 50 is the opioid epidemic. How about obesity? The Joint Chiefs of Staff call it a national emergency crisis because they can't get soldiers, candidates for the military, who aren't overweight, because kids by the age of 18 have spent 2 and 3 years watching a video screen. Look at any sporting event from the 1940s, and I dare you to find someone who is overweight. Look at any sporting event today, and I challenge you to find someone who is not clinically obese. And so though the fact that, you know, the cult of the individual has trumped society to the point where Americans, in a sense, don't believe not only in community, but the very idea of society is no longer, you know, recognized. Everybody thinks that they have to fight for everything. No one deserves anything.
Well, no society is more atomized in that regard than the United States.
And what I try to point out again, you know, I can just tell from your, you know, speaking with you that you, like me, love this country, you know, and we look back on how it saved civilization. It was a better angels of our nature, Monroe and Madison and Lincoln and Roosevelt, you know, but the point is, the problem for Americans is they look in the mirror and they can't see anything but their exceptionalism. So, for example, the country that defined, if you look back to the writings of Benjamin Franklin, he defined education and the free flow of knowledge as the heartblood of democracy. And yet America now finds itself ranking 45th in terms of press freedom. You know, we created a myth of ourselves as this shining city on the hill, receiving the huddled masses of the world. Of course, all these myths are allegorical. It's not like there weren't imperfections at the time in America. It's not like the Irish weren't beaten on in it, you know. But the point is, the myth still becomes a moral rudder, becomes a roadmap of aspiration. And now we have a situation where the majority of Americans across the spectrum prefer a border wall to receiving the desperate families arriving at the border, desperate because of foreign adventures of the United States politically and by the consumption of cocaine by American consumers.
Well, if Trump wins the election, you will have to be busy building a wall across the southern Canada.
That's a funny thing you should say that, but the polls suggest that's all what Canadians want. Look, one of the things I tried to do in this piece was not to, you know, say that Canada was better or, you know, or New Zealand was better, that Australia had done better. But, you know, the bottom line is, if we look around the world, there is a thing called social democracy. And social democracy is not communism light, as the Americans seem to think it is. It's really dynamic capitalism that just seems to focus on all tiers of the society. And in the piece, I try to present a kind of allegory for my, you know, American friends to understand what I'm talking about. You know, if you go to get your groceries, I know because I love Australia and I've been all over your wonderful country. By the way, my oldest daughter's got a new Aussie boyfriend who's killer. But the point is, you go to a grocery store in Australia or New Zealand or Canada, and, you know, you don't necessarily feel like a peer of the clerk at the counter, but you do feel you're part of a wider community. And whereas you go to the States, you feel a kind of a racial, economic, class, educational chasm that is very difficult to bridge. And what's missing is that in Canada, when you get your groceries, you know that they know, the checkout person, that they're getting a living wage because of the unions. And you know, because the grocery stores are neighborhood-based, that probably your kids go to the same public schools that are not funded by local property taxes, which invariably favors the children of the affluent, but by state grants, at least in the case of British Columbia, that give the same resources per capita every kid in the province. And more importantly, the checkout clerk knows that you know that they know that you know that if their kids get sick, they'll get the same medical care, not only of your kids, but of the Prime Minister's kids.
But that's one of the reasons that Canada's done so well with COVID, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, look, we're not a perfect place, and our healthcare system isn't perfect. But the key thing is that, and Australia's got exactly the same point of view, as does New Zealand, as does Denmark, is that our healthcare system, flawed as it can be, we all know about lineups for elective surgery, but the decision is made that we're focused on the collective, not the individual, and certainly not the private investor who views every hospital bed as a rental property. And people forget in the States that universal health care is actually not about medical care. It's not about medicine. It's about social solidarity. It's about fairness. It's about people waking up in the morning and thinking that they are somebody and that the society and the state recognizes them as being somebody. And that is a great strength of social democracies. Let me tell you a quick story. When my mom was 85, she got an aneurysm. And I mean, her chances of survival were negligible. But she got at 11 o'clock in the morning. By 2 o'clock, she was in neurosurgery, and the neurosurgeon, this brilliant Indo-Canadian, saved her life. And we were in the intensive care unit, and beside us was a young girl from Manitoba, a farm family, who by chance had had the same thing saved by the same neurosurgeon the same afternoon. Can you imagine? And my sister and I were looking at this beautiful little girl with her family all around her and thinking, you know, we could have paid for it, but that family couldn't have paid for it. And they would have been forced to a choice between bankruptcy and the life of their child. But in Canada, you don't have to make that choice. And in Victoria, where my mom fell ill, the fanciest hotel in the city, you know, the Fairmont Empress Hotel, one of the great railroad hotels, has a policy that any Canadian family member who's got a relative in an intensive care unit at any hospital in the city gets a free room. So after that moment, we all piled into my old Chevrolet, and with another car and truck, we all poured back, the family from Manitoba and the family from Vancouver. Now, we represented, in, you know, educationally, the elite of Canada. We had gone to Ivy League schools. My sister was a prominent lawyer. I was a writer and a professor, blah, blah, blah. And that farm family was just a Canadian family, but they were wonderful, and they were equal to us. And we all poured back to the bar, and I proposed a toast to our country because, you know, our country made possible that moment that two families from disparate ends of the economic and political spectrum, maybe. We didn't even talk politics, but we were there together as Canadians, and our children and their child and my mother had been saved by our system. And that, you know, what kind of, that's a message of social democracy. And that's what the Americans don't understand. And the thing that is tearing their country apart is the sense that people have that it's not fair. It's not just. Those 62 million Trump voters, some of them, of course, voted because they simply didn't like Hillary Clinton, the way she sounded, her sense of entitlement, the history of her husband, whatever. Yes. But the thing that Steve Bannon, and I just did an interview with Steve the morning before he was arrested, and he loved this piece in Rolling Stone. And I'm not saying that to support him. I'm just saying that what he recognized and what allowed his strategy to unexpectedly put Trump in the White House is that he realized that there was this huge cohort in America who felt they had been left behind by values, by economic opportunities more than anything, and they were angry. Now, the tragedy is that the very decline of America into decadence was most powerfully displayed by the fact that you did have all of those people, 62 million, who chose in 2016 to vote not on what was good for the country or the world, but transparently to vote for someone whose only credential was his willingness to validate their anger, validate their hatreds, target their enemies real and imagined. And that gets back to the whole question of, you know, the way the value system is interpreted. I would say that those in favor of building a wall along the Mexican border are not patriotic. I say that they're acting in a treasonous way. They're committing treason because they're betraying the ideals of America in that kind of attitude. The ones who resist wearing a mask, who go to the beaches, who go to the conventions, who go to the bars, that's not a gesture of strength. It's a statement of weakness of a people who lack the stoicism to endure the epidemic or the fortitude to defeat it.
Okay, now, neither of us would blame Trump for the current situation. He's a symptom, not a cause. But let's go back to the most distinguished ex-president in the US, in the ancient Jimmy Carter. And as you know, he said recently that America's 242-year history has only involved 16 years of peace, making it the most warlike nation in the history of the world. Has war been the U.S.'s undoing?
Well, you know, I mean, we have troops in 150 countries. You know, since the 1970s, America's never been at peace. China's never been at war. We spent $6 trillion on military adventures, all of them failures, since 2001. In those years, every 3 years, the Chinese have poured more cement to build up their nation than America poured in the 20th century. So, you know, if you look at the classic way, and we get back to this notion that empires don't anticipate their demise and all kingdoms, by definition, are born to die. I remember some years ago, my daughter, youngest daughter, was going to a very kind of a intense academic private school, and she was studying the demise of the Roman Empire, and I was helping her prep for a quiz. And, you know, she had to memorize, given that school, you know, 40 reasons Rome had fallen. And I felt like Bill Murray in the movie Groundhog Day. I was sort of going, you know, check, check, check. I mean, a classic sign. America is manifesting all the classic signs of the demise of world powers, including unnecessary and costly foreign adventures, internal corruption, distortions of distribution of wealth, the generation of resentments of those who are being left behind. I mean, it kind of goes on and on. And the sad thing is that if and when America's era does come to an end, and should the torch indeed pass to Asia, China in particular, we will surely become very quickly nostalgic for the best years of the American century.
And we won't be all that happy about the Chinese Empire, given its treatment of, well, everyone from the Tibetans to the Uyghurs.
Absolutely. If you look at the suppression of ethnicities, the suppression of democracy in Hong Kong, the social credit system whereby, maybe some Australians don't know this, but China's implemented a system whereby every individual gets a grade. It's like a report card from the state. And if you have manifested what's deemed to be inappropriate behavior, which could be anything from truly asocial activities to simply seeking freedom of thought, you are deducted points. And those points can mean your dog can be taken away, your children can be denied going to schools, you can be denied. 17 million people were denied last year passage on the high-speed trains. I mean, so...
Well, three cheers for Canada and Australia. For all our shortcomings, we're not there yet. I must say, not everyone shares our views. I had George Friedman on, the forecaster, a couple of weeks ago, wrote a book called The Storm Before the Calm, and he insists that US history has been marked by patterns and trends, and that while America does pass through periods of crisis, they overcome them. He reckons that America will bounce back and that this accords with patterns in its domestic history.
Well, I certainly, you know, no one would be happier if that was true. I'm not so certain. I mean, for example, no matter who is elected in November, in what many have described as the most consequential election in modern American history, the divisions will still be there. Trump has done an extraordinary job at making the truth relative. I mean, think about this. I mean, the great line of American history that President George Washington could not tell a lie. Well, we have a president who can't recognize the truth and has been documented over 20,000 myth-truths and lies in the 3.5 years in office, and yet it does not matter. And in the same way that the algorithms of Facebook only reinforce one's point of view. And most Americans, by the way, get their news from Facebook, not from the media. And so you have a situation where like makes like and reports like. You have a situation where if you look at Fox News and CNN, one is describing the sky as being one color and the other color. In other words, this fundamental division. Look, no society can long endure, as Lincoln said on the eve of the Civil War, when it is fundamentally opposed to itself.
My guest on this LNL on RN Summer is Wade Davis, Professor of Anthropology from the University of British Columbia. I think it's time for us to cheer each other up by going on a certain river together. So let's turn to Colombia, one of your early passions. You fell deeply in love with the place as a teenager, returned years later and wrote a book about the explorer Richard Evans Schultes called One River. Tell me about that, which became a very big success.
Well, the interesting thing about the book One River is I always thought it was a sort of a love letter to Colombia. But on the other hand, it was an account, a very long account of botanical exploration. And one wouldn't expect that to really have that much impact beyond, you know, a small circle of naturalists and anthropologists. But the book came out in Spanish in 2002, translated by an extraordinary Colombian poet. And at a time when Colombia was sort of a failed state, the book kind of became a map of dreams, particularly for young Colombians who were not able to travel within their own nation. And not that the book whitewashed Colombia, but it revealed, you know, in 600 pages, all that was great about Colombia. And the psychological impacts of being seen as a pariah nation are really traumatic. And the book just took on a life of its own, unbeknownst to me. And it became more than a cult book. As I say, it became kind of a map of dreams. And it led me back to Colombia initially to join a team that were doing a series of books to draw attention for young people that their country wasn't a place of violence and drugs, but the greatest biodiversity and natural wonders on Earth, including the greatest number of species of birds, for example. And in the middle of those books, which were not to be sold but gifted to every library in the country to send a message to kids that their country was not a place of violence, I said, well, we've done the land, let's do the rivers. And before I knew it, I had this commission to explore the Magdalena, which is the Mississippi of Colombia. It's a corridor of commerce, but also the fountain of culture, the fountain of poetry and prayer and music and literature.
I understand that it runs over 1,000 miles through every part of Colombia.
Yeah, I mean, the incredible thing about Colombia is that there is no place in Colombia more than a day removed from every ecological niche known to exist on the planet. You know, it is the most bountiful country, the most beautiful country. And a part of the book, you know, it makes a point that it really hasn't deserved its miseries. You know, through all the 50 years of war, a war that was exclusively funded by cocaine profits, and we mentioned that earlier, that, you know, the Medellin cartel was at its height, was making $70 million a day. It was budgeting $1,000 a week just for rubber bands to wrap the illicit cash. Most Colombians who had never seen, let alone used cocaine, found themselves in a vice of war, a war that would never have lasted a day had it not been for that illicit cash. And I remind Americans all the time that if you give me, I mean, in the last year of peace, for example, before the peace agreement in Havana, the FARC were down to 6,000 cadre, mostly teenagers in search of three meals a day. And yet they made $600 million that year from cocaine. So you give me the Sydney Boy Scouts, so the Melbourne Girl Scouts, and $600 million, and believe me, I can wreak havoc in Victoria. You know, the sad thing about it is that 220,000 dead, 7 million internally displaced, 5 million forced to flee their country. How do the Americans feel if they're if Canada's habits of drug consumption and our laws, which did nothing to curtail the trade but facilitated its profit margins by making it, you know, illegal while doing nothing to curb the trade, resulted in 85 million Americans having to leave their homes. Well, that's what per capita happened to Colombians.
Well, we're talking, of course, about the greatest failure in public policy of modern times. That is this ludicrous and self-defeating war on drugs.
Well, you see, the point is the war on drugs is not self-defeating in the sense that if we go back to the memoirs of Ehrlichman, who served with Nixon, he says in his memoirs, we didn't give a damn about drugs. We didn't care about a war on drugs. We saw two openings for the to get hold of the silent majority, race and drugs. And so they created the war on drugs specifically for political purposes. And I can promise you, none of the people fighting the war on drugs from the American side have the slightest interest in the war being won, because they'd all be out of work. You know, $30 and $40 billion spent every year on this ridiculous crusade, which only causes misery. But the people perpetrating that war couldn't care less. They simply want it to go on forever, because that's who they are. And you know, when you think of Colombia, the extraordinary thing about the country is, despite this conflict in good measure imposed upon the country, the country has maintained civil society and democracy, greened its cities, created millions of acres of national parks, sought restitution with indigenous people, unlike any country in the world, and has frankly, you know, laid the grounding for a economic and cultural renaissance. Because you have two generations of young Colombians forced to flee, who are coming back from Melbourne and Sydney and London and Paris and New York and LA with skill sets in every conceivable endeavor. And Colombia is on the edge of a massive renaissance as peace takes hold. It's not an easy peace. It won't be an easy peace. And as long as cocaine is there, it will be the corrosive element threatening the integrity of peace. But the bottom line is, just as the Irish are exhausted and will never again fight that sectarian war, so the Colombians have said, bastante, enough. We want the road of peace.
An indigenous leader said to you that peace will not matter if it's only an excuse for various sides to maintain a war against nature.
Yeah, that was so powerful. And, you know, I'll tell you, I was with the Arawakos, and one of the incredible things about Colombia is the cultural survival of these amazing indigenous peoples. I mean, the Arawakos and the Kogi, the Wiwa and the Kankwana were literally the descendants of the ancient Tairona civilization, vanquished by the Spaniards. And in the wake of the conquest, they retreated into this high volcanic massif that rises higher than any coastal mountain range on Earth. And to this day, in a bloodstained continent, they were never conquered, and they remain ruled by a ritual priesthood. And they look down on the very beaches, where Columbus's men arrived in the third voyage in 1499, 2 hours by plane from Miami Beach. And here's a ritual priesthood of sun priests who literally believe that their prayers and rituals maintain the cosmic balance of the world. And they've become kind of a symbol of patrimony and continuity in Colombia. And so Mamo Camillos told me that line. And I, as we went to the mouth of the Magdalena to make ritual payments, which is what they do, he mentioned that President Juan Manuel Santos would be visiting his village, the main center of the Arawako people in the mountains, 4 days hence. And he asked me, and I've known the people for many, many decades, if I could be there to welcome the president. And I promised to try, knowing full well that the only way of doing it was to hitch a ride in the presidential plane and the helicopters. So I made some phone calls, and word came back from the Palacio Nariño that the president would be happy to have me along. And so I flew from Barranquilla to Bogota and jumped on the presidential plane. As we roared back to the coast, his aides were peppering him with statistics for his speech that would be carried by the national media. And I kind of sheepishly put up my hand and said in Spanish, just what you said, that the Mamos told me that peace won't matter if it's just an excuse for the three sides to come together to maintain a war on nature. And the president made that the theme of his address off the cuff that day. And then we flew back, and I was so taken by him. And then, you know, in the marvelous way of Colombia, where there's so much you can squeeze out of a day, I got to Bogota and I flew right back to the coast where I had come from, only in time for my oldest daughter to be on stage in front of 10,000 people singing an anthem to the Magdalena with Carlos Vives, who's the biggest pop star in Colombia. And then the next day I flew to Medellin, and word came that ex-presidente Uribe, the great antagonist of President Santos, wanted to see me. And so I was told there was a big party at his hacienda on Sunday. And I went up, and as I got to the gates of the hacienda through security, I floated down to the house. There was just one solitary figure there, his beloved wife, the much admired Lina Moreno. And she welcomed me through the house and casually asked me if I had lunch. And before I knew it, I was having a simple family lunch with President Uribe, talking with him about my dream of cleaning up the Magdalena as a symbol of peace. And as I left him, having spent time with both presidents, the two sides of the conflict, if you will, I was able to tell both men in 5 days that it had taken two men to make possible peace in Colombia.
In 2018, Il Presidente traveled to Sierra Nevada for the blessing of the native elders, the American elders, and he said the environment and rights of the indigenous people were more important than commercial interests.
Yeah, I mean, we can say this in Australia, we can say this in Canada. One of the hopeful things is how after decades of, frankly, abuse of the Aboriginal people or the First Nations here in Canada, you know, we're realizing that, you know, the central lesson of anthropology, that every culture has something to say, each deserves to be heard, just as none has a monopoly on the route to the divine, and that the indigenous people of Australia or of Canada don't embarrass the nation state, they enrich it if the state's prepared to accept the wonder of diversity. And it's interesting, Colombia has gone through so many transformations. When I was a boy, you know, 20, 45 years ago, a young plant explorer, when I would say to my friends in Bogota, to their parents, that I was going to live with the mamos of the Arawakos, the parents would say, you know, ¿por qué quiere vivir con la gente sucia? Why do you want to live with the dirty people? And now, as you suggested, the last five Colombian presidents before President Duque, now in office, their first act of office before even being inaugurated has been to go to the Sierra to pay homage to the mamos who have emerged as a symbol of continuity and hope in the country. And so, you know, I think the lesson is that, you know, I'll tell you something, you know, I think Australians will understand this. My dad used to always say, you know, he wasn't a religious man at all, but he always said he believed in good and evil. And he'd say, you know, son, take your pick and get on with it. In other words, you know, none of us are going to win the battle against darkness. You know, it's more of a kind of almost a Buddhist notion, you know, that the journey is not about a destination. It's about a state of mind. It's a path of what side are you going to be on? So, you know, all of these things that trouble us about America or concern us about the path of history, at the end of the day, and I say this to young people all the time, all you can do is do your bit. And if you do your bit, you'll never be disillusioned because you never really expect to win anything. And so you don't become embittered. And that's how I certainly, at my age of 66, I have the energy and the zeal and the passion and the excitement and the love for people everywhere that allows me to be as enthusiastic about what I do today, the books I write. That to me is a great message. You know, despair is an insult to the imagination. Pessimism is an indulgence. Orthodoxy is the enemy of invention. You know, you just have to do what needs to be done and then ask whether it was possible or permissible.
Well, my favorite aphorism is Pablo Casals when he was 80. And Casals said, the situation is hopeless. We must take the next step. And, of course, there is good news from around the place. One of it's in your book. In 2016, the Colombian Constitutional Court granted rights to a river, not the Magdalena, another, but at the heart of the decision was that nature itself has legal standing.
You know, and I think that's, you know, one of the things that did not get into the Rolling Stone piece was the fact that, you know, that one of the great moments about COVID was that it woke us all to the obvious fact that we're living biological beings on a living planet. And we saw evidence so quickly, didn't we, of the resilience of nature. You know, whether it was rivers in Medellin running clear, the channels and back alleys, if you will, of Venice, you know, wild boar in the streets of Barcelona, wildlife in, you know, the flamingos in the wetlands outside of Mumbai, all those marvelous cities in the subcontinent from Karachi to, to Kathmandu, suddenly seeing the high Himalaya in all of their glory scraping the sky for the first time since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. You know, so there was a big message of COVID that will resonate through the ages. You know, one of the things about these pandemics, I mean, there'll be a lot of changes, you know, that will occur, whether it's companies downsizing, more and more people working from home, shopping malls shuttering, movies and entertainment being streamed into the home, all these obvious things we're all talking about. But none of those will shift the dial of history. Similarly, financial insecurity will be with us for a time, but short of a complete financial collapse, the world will find a way to adapt. After all, change is a one constant in history. We're always dancing with new possibilities for life. I mean, the fluidity of memory and our capacity to forget is perhaps the most haunting trait of our species. It allows us to adapt to any degree of social, economic, or, you know, moral degradation. But that said, COVID will not leave the world as it was. And part of what these sorts of conversations are about with your marvelous audience is it's a collective conversation saying, okay, what therefore do we want the world to be in the wake of COVID? You know, what messages do we want to absorb and manifest within ourselves, in a sense, you know? And I think surely aside from this conversation about the demise of American dream, there's a bigger conversation, which is that we are on a living planet. So issues of climate change.
Well, that's one of the things that most concerns me, that while COVID focuses the attention wonderfully, it also distracts. It gives governments an excuse to take the emphasis off something like, well, a much more serious problem long term, climate change.
But, you know, again, there's a moment that's full of potential. You know, it's interesting. It is so fascinating, just like you say, you know, why is it that given all we scientifically know and frankly, all that we can see about the indisputable onset of the consequences of climate change all around us, why were we not able to get traction on that issue and generate the kind of visceral response that we had to COVID? And I mean, obviously, it's something about individuals being immediately and physically threatened, their families being threatened. But just maybe as we've watched our vulnerability and we've woken to the fact that we are interdependent, the very fact that we've been brought to a halt by a biological entity, just maybe this will give us pause to begin to realize that we are interconnected, that the Earth is a finite, very small orb, and that we better get our act together and quickly.
I've been talking to Wade Davis, and let me remind you, he's the author of The Unraveling of America, this extraordinary successful essay via Rolling Stone, and we've also been discussing his new book, the latest of 20, and it's called Magdalena, River of Dreams. Vast in its scope, we can't do it justice, so you have to rush out and buy it now, with your face mask on, of course, and it's published by Penguin Random House. Wade, thank you very much for your time. It's been a great pleasure.
So I just want to say thank you to all my Australian friends. I've been all over your country. I've been in Arnhem Land for a month with the Aboriginals out in the country, and you're just beautiful people, Aussies. You know, and I'm just really proud to be a cousin of you.
Thanks, Wade. Tune in, dear listeners, for more treasures looted from the tomb next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.